And in fact, 2 days after I had had my knee reconstructed, which is about as much fun as it sounds, I was sitting in a Percocet haze and got an email from Chris saying that he thought that there were some real parallels to be drawn between American pragmatism and quantum mechanics, and did I want to come to the Perimeter Institute to speak to these. And in my Percocet haze, I agreed to do this. The next day, in my Percocet haze, I was called into my boss's office to be told that he was going on to bigger and better things, and I agreed to be interim provost. So I'm not sure which of these two things I agreed to is the most crazy, but I bet it was the interim provost rather than coming to talk to the Perimeter Institute. So I really am a tourist. In fact, everything that I know about quantum mechanics, I learned at the feet of Harvey here. But I don't want to lead you on, because twice I tried to sit through Harvey's introduction to the philosophy of physics course in Oxford, and I left after about the third seminar when the board got full of scribbles. So what I'm going to do is tell you what I think is best in American pragmatism. I'm going to gesture at some of the papers that that Chris has kindly sent me, and I'm going to argue that there is a real parallel to be drawn between a certain kind of interpretation of quantum mechanics and American pragmatism, but it's really not the pragmatism of James and Rorty, the pragmatism that's caught Chris's eye for excellent reason, but really the pragmatism of the founder of the doctrine, Charles Sanders Peirce, that holds some really interesting things for the theoretical physicist. And really what I'm going to do is at the end throw some questions out for you to answer for me rather than try to answer them all myself. So I'm not going to wax lyrical about, you know, how best to interpret the measurement problem, because I'll only embarrass myself. But here's the thought coming from quantum mechanics that is allied with American pragmatism. So making a measurement seems to change the process being measured. It's very hard, it appears, to pull apart the observer from the thing observed. So that's the leading thought from quantum mechanics. And the corresponding leading thought from pragmatism is that you can't understand truth, reality, and objectivity independently of our practices of inquiry. So my task is going to be to articulate just what the pragmatists mean by that, give some arguments for it, and see whether this, which kind of pragmatism is best for those like Chris, who see that the metaphysics here of American pragmatism and the theoretical physics sparked by the measurement problem, to see where they meet. So Chris gestures at the kind of view that attracts him by quoting William James, one of the early classical pragmatists. And James says, theories become instruments, not answers to enigmas in which we can rest. We don't lie back upon them. We move forward, and on occasion, we make nature over by their aid. So there's no such thing here as the universe in any completed and waiting to be discovered sense. The universe is under construction. We all have input into giving it shape. So Chris, that's a phrase from Chris, and he goes on to say this. Quantum theory should not be viewed so much as a theory of the world, but rather as a theory of decision-making for agents immersed within a quantum world. That is, a world in continual creation. Nature is being hammered out as we speak. And just like with a good democracy, we all have a non-negligible input into giving it shape. Now, Chris thinks that a much more recent pragmatists, not just William James, but more recent pragmatist Richard Rorty, gets it right when he says that we need to, and then here's a kind of long quote from Rorty, we need to refer all questions of ultimate justification to the future, to the substance of things hoped for. Reason, justification, and truth are not about accurately depicting a permanent structure or about setting out the blueprint for the future. Pragmatists, both classical and neo, do not believe that there is a way things really are. So they want to replace the appearance-reality distinction by that between descriptions of the world and of ourselves, which are less useful, and those which are more useful. When the question, useful for what, is pressed, they have nothing to say except useful to create a better future. When they're asked, better by what criterion, they can only say something as vague as better in the sense of containing more of what we consider good and less of what we consider bad. Now, when Chris sent me the first couple of papers in my Percocet haze with the Rorty quote and the James quote, and then when I fired back my abstract to him, I put him into a state of some panic because I started to suggest that maybe he was a postmodernist sort that thought that anything goes. And he said, no, I'm not that kind of pragmatist. And he sent me some further papers that made it very, very clear that he's not that kind of pragmatist. But Rorty and James, this view that, you know, when we're asked better by what criterion, we can only say, well, you know, better if we consider it better, not so good if we consider it not so good. They really are that kind of postmodernist, anything goes pragmatist. And I think that, and I'll argue this, that this is exactly the kind of pragmatist that you guys must want to stay away from. And you want to travel more towards a kind of more objective sort of pragmatism offered by the likes of Peirce. So first off, it's really unsurprising that these two pragmatists, William James and Richard Rorty, have caught Chris's eye because they're the public face of pragmatism. James was the public face of pragmatism in the early 1900s, and Rorty is the public face of pragmatism now. But it's important to see just what Peirce thought of this kind of pragmatism in 1900. He says that the term pragmatism gets abused in the merciless way that words have to expect when they fall into literary clutches. So then the writer, finding his bantling pragmatism so promoted, feels that it's time to kiss his child goodbye and relinquish it to its higher destiny. While to serve the precise purpose of expressing the original definition, he begs to announce the birth of the word pragmaticism, which is ugly enough to be safe from kidnappers. The trouble is, it's so ugly that it was indeed safe for kidnappers, and no one ever picked up on it. So Peirce continued to work away at articulating pragmaticism, what he thought he had... he was going on about initially, and James continued to march ahead with pragmatism and gave it, I argue, a bad name. Let's first look a little bit more seriously at James and Rorty, just so that we get a full flavor of just what's wrong with it. So James sets out his view on truth and objectivity like this. And this is a very famous passage from James. Any idea upon which we can ride. Chris earlier today said, James is a beautiful writer, and he is a beautiful writer. People say that Henry James, his brother, was a terrible writer, but a good thinker. And William James was a beautiful writer and not so good a thinker, and they're right. But here's a beautiful passage from James. Any idea upon which we can ride. Any idea that will carry us prosperously from one part of our experience to any other part. Linking things satisfactorily, working securely, simplifying, saving labor is true instrumentally. Now, satisfactorily, James goes on to say, and this is a quote, means more satisfactorily to ourselves, and individuals will emphasize their points of satisfaction differently. To a certain degree, therefore, everything here is plastic. And he rather infamously suggested in another very famous paper called The Will to Believe that if the belief in God made a positive or a satisfactory impact on my life, then I should reasonably take it to be true. And if it makes a terrible impact on your life, you can take it to be false. It's true for me and false for you because it has a lousy impact on your life and a satisfactory impact on my life. James's contemporaries immediately leapt on what they saw, not as a theory of truth, but as a theory of some deformed version of it. So Paul Karras, in a 1910 book called Truth on Trial, says that pragmatism replaces the belief in the stability of truth, in its persistence and eternality, with a more elastic kind of truth, which can change with the fashions and makes it possible that we need no longer trouble about inconsistencies, for what is true to one need no longer be true to others, and the truth of today may be real now, and yet it may become the error of tomorrow. And Bertrand Russell and G.E. Moore heaped this kind of objection on James's account of truth and really gave it a black eye for the rest of. Now, Rorty also thinks that truth and the reality that it speaks of are plastic, and he uses this term occasionally as well. But Rorty's got a different, got a, an argument for this that will be important when we look at Peirce. So along with every pragmatist, Rorty thinks that our concept, now we're talking about concepts, our concept of truth can't outrun our practices of inquiry, or our current ongoing conversations, he says, in which we must form our beliefs, make our decisions, and live our lives. So he says, there's nothing deep down inside us except what we've put there ourselves. No criterion that we have not created in the course of creating a practice. No standard of rationality that is not an appeal to such a criterion. No rigorous argumentation that is not obedience to our own conventions. So the transcendental account of truth, or an account of truth that has beliefs or sentences mirroring in the world as it is in itself, just plays no role in our practices, he argues. That's his argument. What inquirers aim at isn't getting the truth about the world. They aim at getting beliefs that work well, that other people will buy. What we aim at, he says, is solidarity, or what our peers will let us get away with saying. And he wants to replace the notion of truth, reality, and objectivity with that kind of notion of solidarity. So it's pretty clear that if Paul Karras were alive today, he'd argue that Rorty also puts truth on trial, and that this is a bad thing. Now, this view has some good arguments against it, and these arguments have nothing to do with quantum mechanics. They have to do with the consistency of arguing as they do. So, right, Rorty and James argue for their view, and they will take on all comers. They'll take on correspondence theorists, and this suggests that they don't think that their view is as good as any other view. Their view of truth is better, they want to say, than the correspondence theorist view. And of course, you know, Rorty and James have a huge number of beliefs about the social, moral, and physical world, and they think that there's a way of adjudicating between their beliefs and the beliefs of others. Otherwise, they wouldn't have them. They wouldn't feel them with such passion. They wouldn't act on them. And this is the kind of objection that I think is delivered and delivered in a completely devastating way to this James Rorty kind of pragmatism. And that's what people think of as pragmatism. Why do they think of that as pragmatism? Well, Peirce never really wrote much that we can get a grip on. He was a brilliant, difficult, and not very modest man. His dear friend James, one thing that one wants always to say about William James is that he was an exceptionally fine person, had a character that is enviable, and he was a dear friend of Peirce who was only nasty to him. So James never abandoned Peirce. He never gave up on his intense but fruitless effort to get Peirce an academic job, a lectureship, or any kind of crumb. And in fact, when Peirce was destitute and sitting in an unheated house in the country without literally enough food to get him through the day, it was James who went round and kind of organized charity that kept Peirce alive for about the last 10 or 15 years of his life. And early on, James says this, well before Peirce starts to lose job after job, "The poor cuss sees no chance of getting a professorship anywhere. It seems a great pity that as an original, a man as he, who is willing and able to devote the powers of his life to logic and metaphysics, should be starved out of a career when there are lots of professorships to be given to safe and orthodox men." Peirce did eventually secure a part-time job at Johns Hopkins, which was then the first kind of real graduate school in the U.S. And there was a scandal. He was married to a very prominent Cambridge a woman from a very prominent Cambridge family, and he was not faithful, and she divorced him, and he got married 6 days later, and this did not go over well. Simon Newcomb, his colleague at the Coast Survey, was instrumental in getting him fired from that Johns Hopkins job, and then eventually from the Coast Survey. But what I want to say here, and it's a long way of saying it, is that Peirce had a stunted career, wrote thousands of pages, scribbled manuscripts. It's no accident that we don't have easy access to his work. But I also want to make clear that he was a real scientist. Because he didn't have an academic job, he worked for decades at the U.S. Coast Survey, making really significant advances in pendulum studies to determine the shape of the Earth, in photometric research on stars, and in chromatics. He was also a brilliant logician, came up with a quantified first-order deductive logic at the same time, but completely independently as Frege, invented the Scheffer stroke 30 years before Scheffer. He was someone who wanted to put forward a view of truth and reality that really did walk hand-in-hand with science. Of course, he had no access to the physics of today, but he would be, and I was just talking to Chris earlier about this, he would be deeply interested in the fact that some physicists might take his metaphysical view to fit with the quantum world. So let me now get to the heart of the matter, which is Peirce's view. So this is Peirce's pragmatic maxim. He says, "We must not begin by talking of pure ideas, vagabond thoughts that tramp the public roads without any human habitation. But we must begin with men and their conversation." When this pragmatic maxim is turned on the concept of truth, the upshot is an aversion to transcendental accounts of truth, like the correspondence theory, on which a true belief is a belief that corresponds to or gets right the believer independent world. This kind of account of truth is an example of those vagabond thoughts that tramp public roads without any human habitation. They make truth the subject of empty metaphysics, for the very idea of a believer-independent world and the items within it that our beliefs might correspond seems graspable only if we could step outside of our corpus of belief, our practices, or that with which we have dealings, per se. We would do better to illuminate the concept of truth by considering its linkages with inquiry, assertion, and belief. for those are the human dealings relevant to truth. So Peirce's view of truth is a resolutely naturalist view. We shouldn't add anything metaphysical to science or to any other first-order inquiry. We have to extract the concept of truth, as it were, from our practices of inquiry, reason-giving, and deliberation. But Peirce, unlike Rorty, thinks that our practices have at their very center the concept of truth. But Rorty thought that there's no room for the concept of truth. Our practices just do without it. Truth is irrelevant to our practices. We take ourselves, Peirce argued, to be aiming at the truth. We want to know what methods might get us true belief. We want to know whether it's worth our time and energy to inquire into certain kinds of questions, whether a discourse such as moral discourse aims at truth or at getting things right, or whether it's a radically subjective matter not at all suited for truth value. This will become important later, right? But we want to know whether it's worth our time and energy to inquire into certain questions, whether they actually give us determinant answers. We also distinguish between thinking we're right and being right. We also think that we can improve our beliefs, that we can learn from our conversations with others, that we can learn from experience. Peirce argues that all of these things are quite literally parasitic on the notion of truth. You can't make sense of them without the notion of truth. So that's his argument for why we need an account of truth, not the correspondence account, but an account of truth. And then here's his account of truth. He says that a belief is true if it would be indefeasible, if it wouldn't be improved upon, if it would never lead to disappointment, if it would forever meet the challenges of reason, argument, experiment, inquiry. A true belief is one which would withstand doubt were we to inquire as far as we could into the matter. So truth is out of our reach, but it's not out of our reach in the spurious correspondent sense, where we could never have access to it. It's out of our reach because it marks a relationship between our beliefs and some better state of our beliefs, right? It marks the indefinite betterment of our beliefs and of our practices of justification. So this is an innocuous way of truth being out of our reach. Now, Peirce occasionally put this idea in a really unhelpful way. And this is the kind of rumor of what he was on about. He said sometimes, not very often, that a true belief is one that we're fated to believe. It's one that would be believed in the final opinion. Now, that sounds an awful lot like there's, to use a phrase of Chris's, a dream of a final theory when all the evidence is in, right? We'd have it. There, bango, we've got it. But these were slips of Chris's. His considered view is that a true belief is one that would be indefeasible. It would just continue to stand up to whatever we could throw at it. That's all the truth amounts to. And he often went on and on about how you can't really make sense of the final opinion. It was just a phrase that he used occasionally. So here's his absolutely core central metaphor. Inquiry, he says, is not standing upon the bedrock of fact. It is walking upon a bog and can only say, this ground seems to hold for the present. Here I will stay until it begins to give way. This is very similar to Neurath's metaphor about rebuilding the boat of knowledge while we're at sea. You can't start in the dry dock from, you know, with certain, you know, infallible planks. You're a sailor adrift at sea, and all you can do is replace the rotten planks as they come up. Well, purses, right? We're walking upon a bog, and all we can say is this ground is stable now. It's working, and I'm going to stay here until I'm faced with recalcitrant experience, and then I'll move. Now, Chris has used a similar metaphor, and I think it's very, very similar. He says that we're swimming in the thick of things, in an undulant sea, trying to keep our heads above the water. He says that all the concepts in our theories must be interpreted to do with points of view we can construct from within the world. We have to loosen the idea that a physical law is a mirror image of what is in the world and replace it with something that expresses instead how each of us can best cope with and hope to take advantage of the world exterior to ourselves. Right? It's very, very similar to Peirce's metaphor, except for the each of us. Right? So here's that last sentence from Chris. We're to replace this mirror image view of the world with something that expresses instead how each of us can best cope with and hope to take advantage of the exterior world. That phrase, each of us, I think belongs with Rorty and James and not with Peirce, because Peirce thought that science, rationality, and truth were matters for the community of inquirers, not for individual inquirers. Since individual inquirers have finite lives, it seems to Peirce that logicality inexorably requires that our interests shall not be limited. They must not stop at our own fate, but must embrace the whole community. We're warranted, for instance, in making probability assignments or inferences which depend on a relative frequency in the long run, because we can see that if everyone made them, then in the long run, inquirers would not be led astray. But since my own lifetime is limited, I can't be guaranteed that my own inferences are going to be correct, that they won't lead me astray. So this is the basis of his solution to the single case problem. In the one-off trial, the inquirer is justified in acting in a certain way, because if everyone acted in that way, the long-run success would be extremely high. On the whole, he says, the species will survive longer if we follow the method of science rather than some other method, the method of astrology, of Christian Science, or looking at our crystal ball. So when Chris says that the current state of science is the best known means for survival, the pragmatists are very much on the same page. In fact, the pragmatist account of truth and objectivity arose in a complete frenzy of enthusiasm for Darwin's Origin of the Species, which had came out in 1859, and the pragmatists in, you know, the early mid-1860s were starting to come up with this view of truth, and as far as they're concerned, the two were very clearly linked. So Peirce would agree with Chris that you can say that one theory is better than another without saying that the better theory gets the world as it is in itself right. One theory is better than another because it helps us, because it survives the rigors of inquiries better than its rivals. But notice that this entails something a lot more objective than James or Rorty wanted to surmise. Theories survive for a certain kind of reason, not because a dictator requires that one believe in them, not because they make us feel comfortable, not because we would be wretched if we didn't believe them. So this is what Peirce says of James's will to believe. He says, your will to believe is such that it injures a serious man. What you've said is that this theory is true because I would be wretched if I didn't believe it. And Peirce just thought this was an abomination, right? So theories survive not because they make me feel more comfortable or because I would be wretched if I didn't believe the theory. Theories that really do survive are such that they cohere with experience, they predict future experiences, they help us get along in the world, they help us build bridges that don't fall down. That's a lot more objective than James or Rorty is willing to suggest. And the reason science is the method that has the greatest survival value is that science is a method that takes itself to be constrained by experience. So Peirce argued that we're in touch with the world through brute experience, through the world impinging on us. Experience, he says, is the bumping up against hard fact that characterizes our lives. So this is what he says of those idealists who think that they deny the reality of the external world. Very well, an idealist of that stamp is lounging down Regent Street when some drunken fellow unexpectedly lets fly his fist and knocks him in the eye. What has become of his philosophical reflections now? As Chris puts it in one of his papers, we know that the world exists because we get unpredictable kicks from it all the time. But Peirce was also clear that once we try to articulate anything about those kicks, once we try to say something about what we experience, we invoke our own interpretations, our ends, our concepts, our worldview. So we're connected to the real world by experience. But all experience provides us is that indexical connection to the world. He describes what he sees in his study. But hold, what I have written down is only an imperfect description of the percept that is forced upon me. I've endeavored to state it in words. In this, there has been an endeavor, purpose, something not forced upon me, but rather the product of reflection. I recognize that there is a percept or flow of percepts very different from anything I can describe or think. What precisely that is, I cannot even tell myself. I'm forced to content myself not with the fleeting percepts, but with the crude and possibly erroneous thoughts or self-informations of what the percepts were. Everything we experience, Peirce argues, is interpreted and hence fallible. Going back to the first impressions of sense, he says, would be the most chimerical of undertakings. So to the question, is there something in nature when there are no observers or agents about that old question about whether the tree falls in the forest and there's no one to hear it, does it make a sound? Peirce answers, yes, there is something in nature when there are no observers about, but we can't say anything about it. For our theories and our statements and our sayings about the world are our theories and our statements. So what the observer finds cannot be detached from the observer. And that's that link to the leading thought in quantum mechanics. And Chris puts it nicely when he says, the mark of reality is its indescribability. Now, again, Peirce didn't have the quantum mechanical context in mind, but the two views are very much running in tandem there. So let's go back to this bit of real objectivity that the Peircean brand of pragmatism has. Our bumping up against hard fact makes it such that, to extend the metaphors further, we're not walking or swimming in circles. We're walking across the bog and in the undulating sea in what we take to be the right direction. Scientific theories, as Chris says, evolve and survive because the survivors have a kind of staying power that none of the rest of the competition have. And I assume that he thinks, again with Peirce, that that staying power arises because the theories continue to fit with and predict the future course of experience, not with James and Rorty, because we would feel wretched without them. So on the view, which I think is shared by Peirce and Chris, knowledge and inquiry aren't attempts at accurately representing reality, at getting things right, whatever that might mean. Knowledge and inquiry are attempts at saving the phenomenon, predicting future experience, etc. And this is what keeps the two of them away from rampant idealism or that postmodern spectrum. But let's move now to a part of Peirce's view that intersects, and perhaps problematically so, with issues at the center of quantum mechanics, his thoughts about the principle of bivalence. So at first, when I started putting this bit of the paper together, I thought, okay, well, here is where someone who interprets quantum mechanics, as Chris does, is just going to part company with Peirce and say, no, you're far too objectivist for me. But actually, on reflection, I think that there's a nice way of making two views draw together. So Peirce argues that it's a regulative assumption of inquiry that we would find an answer to any question that's pressing upon us. Otherwise, it would be pointless to inquire into the matter. He says the only assumption upon which we can act rationally is the hope of success. Thus, the principle of bivalence for any sentence P, P is either true or false, the principle of bivalence, rather than being a law of logic, is a regulative assumption of inquiry. And this is absolutely at the heart of Peirce's view. His argument is that if we're to inquire rationally about some particular issue, then we have to assume that there's a determinate and right answer to our question. This appears to be in direct tension with the interpretation of the measurement problem, which makes pragmatism the friend of quantum mechanics. It suggests that there's no fact of the matter, quantum mechanics suggests, that there's no fact of the matter until we make an observation. And this is where I initially thought that Peirce and Chris would part company, but again, I suspect not. So Peirce made it very clear that his point about bivalence being a regulative assumption of inquiry was not a claim about its special logical status, that the principle is a logical truth, nor is it a claim about the nature of the world, that the world is such that the principle of bivalence holds. Indeed, it's not even that we should fully believe this kind of assumption. He says, and this is, once you know how little money Peirce has, this strikes home, I do not admit that indispensability is any ground of belief. It may be indispensable that I should have $500 in the bank because I've given checks to that amount. But I've never found that the indispensability directly affected my balance in the least. He also says, we must make this kind of assumption for the same reason that a general who has to capture a position or see his country ruined must go on the hypothesis that there is some way which he can and shall capture it. So that we need to assume that bivalence holds is a claim about inquiry and what those engaged in inquiry must take for granted in order to make their practice comprehensible. And he's crystal clear about this. Elsewhere, he says that the principle of bivalence is taken by logicians to be a law of logic by a saltus, an unjustified leap. Peirce's view is that, he says, we are obliged to suppose, but we need not assert that there's a determinate answer to our questions. He says, for example, when we discuss a vexed question, we hope that there's some ascertainable truth about it, and that the discussion is not to go on forever and to no purpose. A transcendentalist would claim that it is an indispensable presupposition that there is an ascertainable true answer to every intelligible question. I used to talk like that myself, for when I was a babe in philosophy, my bottle was filled from the udders of Kant. But by this time, I have come to want something more substantial. Right? So it's not that the transcendentalist view is that if you have a proposition, a presupposition, you prove that it's true. Versus view is that you have a presupposition, All you've proved is that you have to assume it in order to keep going on with your practice. Nothing about having to presuppose something shows that it's true. And here is where I think things get more interesting in terms of quantum mechanics. It's important to see that we don't make this leap, this saltus, this assumption, everywhere. So let's look at the interesting case of morals and politics. Here, our very practices are thinking about what is just or about the best way to arrange society, our debates about what laws to support, what who to vote for in the election, are as parasitic on the idea of truth as are our other inquiries. So anytime, again, this is the argument against that Rorty James view, if I'm arguing with you that it's better to support Obama than McCain, and you know I'm passionate about that, you know, that argument is as parasitic on the concept of truth if I'm arguing with you that there are only three people in this room rather than 33. Right? There's the fact that we're arguing suggests that each of us thinks that there's an answer to the question. So morals and politics is a realm of inquiry that relies on the notion of truth. It's parasitic on the notion of truth. We assume that lots of our questions have determinate answers, but we don't assume that all of our questions have determinate answers. So if I'm arguing with you not about who to vote for in the election, but whether it's better to give the money that I've set aside for charity to Oxfam or to the United Way, I might think that there's no determinate answer to that question. Right? I decide to give to Oxfam, you might decide to give to the United Way. We're not going to fight about this, we're not going to argue about this. Why? Because here, there's a truth value gap. But it's not that we agree to disagree, it's that we agree that there's no fact of the matter about whether it's better to give money to Oxfam or to the United Way. And we can multiply this kind of example indefinitely. So morals and politics, these are kinds of inquiry that require the concept of truth, but we don't think that truth values are spread thick on the ground. We think there are truth value gaps all over the place in morals and politics. And perhaps questions about the quantum world are like that. Perhaps quantum mechanics forms a subset of science within which we do not assume that bivalence holds. So with respect to the quantum world, we might have truth value gaps, places where there is only underdetermination. And this fact may or may not have implications about the truth values of our statements about middle-sized objects, like tables and chairs and how many people are in this room. So is it just the quantum world where the scientist doesn't assume that bivalence holds, if she assumes that bivalence doesn't hold? What about the world of tables and chairs? Are we hammering that out as well? So this, I'm not going to try to answer these questions, but just to suggest that it's possible, right? So if you have this interpretation of the quantum world, there's no determinate answer, it's possible that that could form a subset of science where there is no determinate answer, but with all sorts of other kinds of inquiry, you think that there are determinate answers. So really, what the answers to those meta questions will show you if you say, no, if there's indeterminacy of the quantum world, the indeterminacy goes all the way up. It'll show that you have a kind of foundationalist view of the quantum world. But if you think you can hive off the quantum world, there's indeterminacy there, but it's perfectly determinate whether there are 3 or 33 people in this room, then you'll have a different view of the relationship between the quantum world and the rest of the world. So these are questions, obviously, that are up to you lot to decide. But nothing in the pragmatist view of truth and reality prejudges them. And so the pragmatist could go either way on the answers to those questions. So one thing, though, that we can say is the following. In James's well-known words, the trail of the human serpent is over everything. Standards of truth and objectivity are our standards. But this doesn't toss us into a sea of post modern arbitrariness, where truth varies from person to person and culture to culture. Nor does it require us to abandon our concepts of truth, reality, and objectivity. As Peirce stressed, we're always immersed in a context of inquiry, where the decision is to be made is a decision about what to believe from here, not what to believe were we able to start from scratch, from certain infallible foundations. But of course, we don't go forward arbitrarily. Right? When we're in the bog and we're forced to move because experience is recalcitrant, we don't move any old way. We move in the way that we think best. So the central and deep pragmatist challenge is how we should go from present practice to a future practice where our very standards themselves may be thrown into question. And clearly, this is something that quantum physics has done. It's actually thrown some of our very standards themselves into some question or at least confusion. So as Arthur Fine, who's a kind of pragmatist and someone who's very interested in physics, put it recently in a volume that I edited on called New Pragmatists, Fine being one of them, we're in the position of Kuhn's revolutionary scientist who must choose how to project the values of established practice into new terrain, and at the very same time must oversee how things go and adjust accordingly. So nature is, the pragmatist says, being hammered out as we speak. But it's not being hammered out in any old way. And that, I think, is the person view, and I submit it's also Chris's view. He hasn't been looking too skeptical during this. So that's it, and I'll let you tell me whether you think I got anything right. So why don't we let Chris have the first word, and then or are you just stretching?
No, I was surprised because I didn't realize I sounded so much like a philosopher.
Surely everyone else in this room realizes you sound so much like a philosopher.
You know, I told you the story about how I became a pragmatist. It was because I had given a talk and someone called me an American pragmatist, and I went and I found a book that had an article titled "Why I'm Not a Pragmatist." It was by Martin Gardner, and I read it and I realized I was a pragmatist. So I have to admit to you that I've never read more than a paragraph of Peirce. I've read about Peirce, and every time I've tried to open up one of Peirce's articles, I get about a paragraph into it, and then I give up. But I think now I'll try to go read Peirce. I have a whole bunch of questions, but I'm not going to ask a whole bunch of questions. Maybe we'll see what happens. But the first one is you kept contrasting, or maybe the only one for right now, and then I'll let you go to Lee. You kept contrasting the James Rortian theory of truth, or the James and Rorty version of pragmatism, with Peirce's version of pragmatism. You never mentioned Dewey. Where does he sit in your mind?
More with James and Rorty than Peirce.
And why did you exclude him from the?
Just for simplicity. You didn't mention him very much, and just for simplicity.
No, I've never been able to read him either.
He's so boring. God, he's boring.
You know,
he's excruciating.
I get these collections of papers, you know, because he wrote so much. And the introductions to Dewey's writings are great.
Yeah.
And I find that I like that a lot, but I never can read him.
Yeah, no, he's excruciating.
Okay, so you view him as living closer to James. And, so it seems to me that there's really a spectrum from Peirce. So if I were to put it in the way I see it, at least, there's Peirce, who's pretty much like a physicist, a practicing physicist, then to Dewey, then to James, and then Rorty out here somewhere.
Although there's a Rorty that sounds an awful lot like Peirce. The good Rorty and the bad Rorty, people would say.
Thank you.
I'm going to try to use this as an opportunity to have a conversation through your interpretation of Chris to Chris. Because what you've done, which is remarkable, does not happen some of Chris, and is put Chris in a context that maybe I can respond. So I'm going to start with your statement that the real question is how to go from present to future practice. And what that means for those of us who are puzzled about quantum mechanics is, to me, is do we choose to investigate understanding or giving a language to make sense of the quantum formalism and practice is given to us, or do we come to the conclusion that there's something, as Einstein thought and others, De Broglie and Schrodinger, there's something unacceptable about quantum mechanics and insist on the attempt to overthrow it and replace it with something else. Now, you made a big point, and I like it very much, that Peirce believed there was an imperative, and I'll try to tell, this is a question, so this is a translation of what I think you're saying about Peirce's imperative. Through your emphasis that sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. There are two kinds of questions that we may trouble ourselves with. There are questions for which determined argument based on rational deductions from public evidence can hope to succeed to reach agreement, and there are those for which it can't. And what, in some sense, Peirce's pragmatism, the way I understand your presentation of it, is a statement that we have to be committed in the first case to follow it through as far as it goes, and that's why we're not left with subjectivity or anything goes, postmodernism or whatever, because there's a commitment to, in the cases where argument has to reach an end, to argue till we reach an end. And in some sense, that's what holds the community of rational seekers together. Now, the question is, the question that Chris raises through your presentation of Chris is, can the fact that some questions in quantum mechanics are unanswerable, like some observables in some states don't have definite values, can we be satisfied with that? Or must we be unsatisfied with it and take the view that anything that would be called science is in the first class of questions, and if it's so, and if we're faced with the claim of a theory of physics in which there are well-formed questions that don't have answers, are we constrained to try to overthrow that physical theory? So that, for me, is a way to set the issue, and to sort of ask, and of course, this question is in the domain of questions that we don't have enough evidence to decide, but should we be happy with a reading of quantum mechanics which somehow says that it's okay that some well-formed questions don't have answers? Or should we insist that that's really a fault of quantum mechanics and there must be another set of questions, another language of description in which every well-formed question has an answer?
See, I think that the answer to that question rides on the answer to those two questions that I threw out at you. So does it make good sense to say that there's indeterminacy at the quantum level, but not all the way up or down? Mm-hmm. Right? So my kind of completely uneducated thought would be, well, no, surely the quantum world's at the bottom of the world of tables and chairs. So if it's unacceptable that there's indeterminacy about how many chairs are in this room, it's unacceptable that there's indeterminacy of the quantum world. But I'm ignorant, right?
So
if your answer to that question is the quantum world is at the bottom of the rest of the world, then I would think that you will lean towards thinking that the way to go forward is to try to overturn the results that you get in the quantum world.
Yeah, just to address that, we can easily construct quantum states of this room in which the number of chairs is indeterminate, and in which that comes about, these are called Schrodinger's cat paradoxes, in which that comes about as a result of an indeterminate measurement on an atom. So the answer is yes, and I think your argument is very germane.
Yep.
Isn't a question not well formed if you can't have a definite answer?
So here's a so first, here's what Peirce said, and then
Peirce
thought that a question lacked legitimacy if there was nothing that could speak for or against it.
Right.
So here's a kind of verificationist or positivist, as were all the practicists. But it's just, you know, if there's really nothing that could speak for or against a view, then it's empty experience.
Right.
But it could be that a question had an answer that was a disjunct. Right? So is it morally acceptable to give your money to Hitler Youth? Well, rephrase that. So, you know, the question is, what is it morally acceptable to give your charity a bundle of money to? The answer, one would think, would be at this junction, right? Oxfam, United Way, and on and on and on and on. But the Hitler Youth wouldn't be part of that disjunction. It wouldn't be a disjunction. Right, so that, let's just say that's the answer to that question. What is it morally acceptable to give your charity dollars to? There, you don't have a determinate answer in the way that we usually think about determinate answer. That is the answer. You have a determinate answer that's long disjunct. And I actually got this from Kathleen ages ago. She offered me this solution. I think that's right. So the question is perfectly well formed. There's a determinate answer if you think of determinism in terms of this junction, but there's no one unique answer. You can think of other questions that are slightly different, but also have no determinate answer. So, you know, when you are thinking about character traits, untested character traits of someone who is dead now, so you can never test them. So Dunn had a famous example, right? It was Jones' grave, when Jones was never ever placed in a position where he had to show if he was brave or not. Is there an answer to that question? Well, some people think that it's a well-formed question, maybe, right? But maybe there's no determinate answer to it. It's not like saying blah, 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 right? Or, you know.
It's a hidden variable.
It's a hidden variable. So, I mean, this is a really kind of deep question that you've asked. You know, I've kind of found some ways in sort of try to work your way through it. Do you want to make your question sort of more specific about the quantum world?
Is that right, the example from quantum mechanics would be the question, what is the position of a electron that has a known momentum. And so if you were to carry out that measurement, then it would have a position in the measurement. But this is presuming you're asking the question previous to that measurement. And I would say, in my opinion, that would be not a well-formed question within the context of quantum mechanics.
Why wouldn't it be well-formed?
Because if it has no momentum, then it doesn't have a definite position when you ask that question.
Right.
So it doesn't make sense to ask what its definite position is if it doesn't have a definite position.
But it has one or the other. Right. Could you formulate a disjunction? And would that be a kind of answer that might be acceptable? I mean, I'm not suggesting that is the answer that's acceptable. It's just, you know, if you're going to hammer away at the idea that it's not a well-formed question, you know, you need a kind of argument about well-formedness. You need some kind of you know, some kind of criterion, like a verificationist criterion, that's really going to rule out all those kinds of questions. And then we, you know, we do have these examples kind of kicking around of other kinds of questions where, you know, that it seems like this, you know, may not be a determinate answer. But so, I mean, one way of thinking about it is just, right, is the following way. So my process is the regulative assumption of inquiry. The question we're asking has an answer. So one thing we know, if the question we're asking doesn't have a determinate answer, is that we shouldn't be inquiring into it. Right? It's a you know, let's not. It's silly to you know, exert ourselves on this question. Now, if you bump the thing up a level, as Lee was trying to, then the question is, well, actually, not should we inquire into the position of, you know, this particle, but rather should we inquire into whether we ought to continue thinking of the quantum world in this way, or is there a better way? That's a perfectly legitimate question. You want to say anything here, Harvey? Hey, Jim, I brought you here for tech support. You're not.
I may be digging the hole even deeper, but I was just going to make a remark about questions that we ask in physics that don't have definite answers. This is not restricted to quantum mechanics. Take a very simple-minded thing in classical mechanics, like what is the absolute velocity of a body? That doesn't make sense. What is the color of an atom? That doesn't make sense. These kinds of questions are not restricted to quantum mechanics. And could I make a remark also about the wider issue of pragmatism in science? There's something very appealing, if you like Occam's razor, there's something very appealing about the pragmatist account of truth. Because it's really about things that work. And you say a proposition is true if it really is extremely successful, it's satisfactory in all these robust ways. Not because it has some shining property that makes it reflect, in some metaphysical sense, the nature of reality. So if you are sort of a minimalist about commitments, ontological or metaphysical commitments, there's something very, very attractive about it. And it makes sense of this idea that the mark of reality is its indescribability, insofar as I understand that. But now the question arises, if you're a pragmatist, would you be more drawn, say, to quantum mechanics than to, say, general relativity? Now, it seems to me that you shouldn't. If this is the correct way of understanding truth, then it really doesn't cut any ice to appeal to quantum mechanics, because in general relativity, you have a completely different approach to asking physical questions. General relativity doesn't seem to be dependent on conceptual problems, but it should be subsumable into a pragmatist of truth. Yes, because it works, and works very, very well. Now, of course, there's an option here. You could say, actually, general relativity is not really true, the real McCoy. It's quantum mechanics that brings out pragmatism.
Right.
And then you have the following problem. Well, is general relativity refuting pragmatism? Is it inconsistent with pragmatism? Or do we have to understand that quantum mechanics is somehow more fundamental, and that it's what's really showing the truth of pragmatism? Or should we simply say pragmatism is an approach, it's a broad approach to the notion of truth, and it should be applicable to, if it's going to be any good, it should be applicable to any theory, whether it's quantum mechanics.
So here's the way to think about this question. So I went on about how the reason theories survive is that they help us to predict the course of experience. It's not that they survive because people feel wretched if they can't leave them. But that's only one aspect of what the person's talking about. So truth for him is a belief or a theory surviving the rigors of inquiry. Right. And those rigors aren't just about predicting the future course of experience. Right? That's not all we're aiming at when we inquire. But we're also aiming at getting a simple, elegant theory. We're also aiming at explaining other things from other theories. Right? So, you know, you lot have some reasons for being interested in quantum mechanics over and above being interested in general relativity. Right? Those reasons arose in the context of inquiry. Right? Therefore, quantum mechanics is fulfilling some aims of inquiry. And that's Peirce's picture of truth. So quantum mechanics betters general relativity for precisely the reasons that you're interested in. Right? So it's working in terms of predicting the future course of experience or actual experience is but one slice of what it is for a theory to survive the rigors of inquiry. So Peirce's view really is wedded to scientific inquiry, you know, in other domains, mathematical inquiry, moral inquiry, in the following way. It's a complete marriage, right? It says, look, we have local aims in inquiry, predicting experience, getting a simple, all those pragmatic virtues that, right, correspondences, and it feels pragmatic as if the virtues that they identify. So we have this range of things that we aim at, this range of virtues, and the best belief is the belief that satisfies those aims, right? So whatever your aims are, right, you know, that's what's rational, whatever fulfills them, that's what's rational to believe. So, you know, the person would be keen on quantum mechanics for precisely the reasons that you're keen on. So it's only a kind of crude sort of pragmatism that says, you know, truth is what works in experience, you know, helps you get on with the world. Otherwise, you're right. Relativity theory were better others. Yeah,
let me follow up on something you said, and it's an elaboration of your point. It's actually got me to thinking, and there was a program of quantum logic. Heyday is long past, it never went anywhere. But it actually focused on examples like yours, elaborated in just the way you were saying. Got momentum P and conjunction, disjunction of positions. Okay, so P and bracket x1 or x2 or and so on. And then if you wanted to be a kind of realist in this view, you would embrace that proposition. P was known. We don't know what the location is, the x is, but it's got to be one of them. And then they would say, now here's the trick. You have to abandon classical logic. You're no longer allowed to go from that proposition to the following. P and x1 or P and x2. You see that? Now that's just an ordinary inference in classical logic. It's the distributive law. And you could say, well, this just shows how complicated it is. Because somebody could have the kinds of instincts that want to acknowledge the uncertainty principle on one hand, but don't want to say the damn world's indeterminate. Okay? It's determinate. It's just, there's just these problems about what you can manage to know. But you have to violate classical logic in order to cling to these beliefs all simultaneously. Now, so here's my question for you. Okay, now I'm just sort of conjuring this up because of these nice examples. You sort of said Peirce was had this, he was going to embrace excluded middle for methodological reasons, as opposed to thinking it was a Platonic,
yeah.
Right, as opposed to it's a Platonic truth that we know. Well, then I would think probably by parity of argument, he might say we should similarly embrace the distributive law as a kind of precondition for, you know, doing work in the world. But then when you're faced with an example like this, it's not clear, you know, whether you want to give up, you know, just what it is you want to, you know, you want to give up on where the tension is. I could even see Peirce saying, damn, there goes the distributive law.
Yeah. So I really do want to say that nothing in Peirce's view prejudges the answers to these questions. That is really up to you, right? So, you know, to follow up on these questions. So you have to decide how best to go forward. So the nice thing about pragmatist view of truth and objectivity is that it's about, right? And it may be that an interpretation of measurement problem is such that you end up, you know, deciding that the way to go forward is to dump classical logic. But that'll be a decision that has, you know, all sorts of implications for other ways of thinking in other domains of inquiry. You know, my guess would be that that's not the way you'll go. But if that's the way you go, and if that view continues to stand up, and you know, it has fruitfulness for other research, and it doesn't get overturned, then that's all the truth means, right? You know, each person in this room will take take a crack at guessing, predicting whether, you know, which interpretation is going to survive. But you know, some of you will be right and some of you will be wrong. Now, a theory can survive, Chris is really clear about this, we can go wrong for generations. There's nothing about the fact that a theory is well established now that proves it to be true. Science can just take off in the wrong direction for generations. Because he formulates his view of truth with the subjunctive conditional, he can still say, right, even if the view is believed on and on and on and on, it could still be false because it wouldn't be the best view. It wouldn't stand up to everything you could throw at us. That's the way in which truth is just always out of our reach, right? So we can go wrong for generations, even if we never right ourselves, first it makes sense of still having a false view, because there would be a better view that would best not just account for the experience, but would account for, you know, our intuitions about, you know, logic and how it works everywhere else. That's just back up here. No?
So it seems to me that there are two ways in which philosophy can be useful in physics, which are related, but you can separate them. One is in theory interpretation, and the other is in theory construction. So theory interpretation is when you've already got a theory, and you're trying to interpret it, understand it better. Whereas theory construction is where you don't have a theory, and you're trying to sort of use some historical principles, maybe, to construct a new theory. So the second sort of thing is appealing, you know, because that's how you get new theories. And also it appeals, I think, to the opportunist. That's inherent in most physicists, which is, you know, what philosophy can I use to make some progress? I don't care if I believe that philosophy or not. So then my question is, if you were to tell a physicist acting as an opportunist to be a pragmatist, take for example like Peirce, what exactly would they do in constructing new physical theories? Can you describe what kinds of thinking they would engage in to construct a new physical theory?
Yeah. Okay, that's a nice question because, you know, if I've just said, you know, Proust's view doesn't prejudge the answers to any of these questions, but as your question makes very clear, of course it prejudges them in the following way, right? When I tell you how the Persian pragmatist would construct a new theory, you're going to get a good whiff of the kind of answer that Persian pragmatist would give to those questions. So here's how the Persian pragmatist would advise / require a new theory to be constructed. First principle is going to be, let's call it verification, that's too narrow a word, but you know, Peirce was crystal clear, theories have to cash out in experience. So if you have a theory with no empirical consequences, you know, you've got yourself something spurious. So here already, you know, people are like, well, surely that prejudges it. So that's, you know, that's the first. The second thing he's going to argue is that don't make the mistake of adopting a very narrow account of experience where only the senses will deliver experience to you. He thought that you could have experience is just shock, surprise, impinging, right, the, you know, brute fact of reality, kicking us up the side of the head. he thought that you could have experience in diagrammatic contexts, which meant that mathematics and logic were experimental areas of inquiry, and hence they were legitimate hypotheses and theories. You can be surprised by in a proof, in an argument. So, first he says it's got to be empirically verifiable, and then with one hand, and on the other hand, he kind of takes some of the sting of that away by saying, and that's a whole lot, that's a broader context than you might first imagine. And then he's going to say, and again, you know, I can hear myself, you know, saying, well, maybe the answer is prejudged. He's going to say, if you're inquiring, if this is a matter of serious inquiry for you, then you have to assume that there's an answer to the question at hand. And so that suggests that, you know, what I hear me saying is that, you know, maybe you want to resist certain interpretations of quantum mechanics. So here you've got an interesting setup. You've got pragmatism that says truth about reality, objectivity are not things that are independent of the inquiry. So you have something that looks like it's very attractive to, I don't know if you guys use this term, but the anti-realist interpretation of quantum mechanics. But then, you know, when you flesh it out a little bit more, this is why initially I thought that this, you know, Chris was very good assumption was going to be a point at which Chris said, well, I'm not interested in that. But then you've got a conception of what inquiry is that pushes you towards a more objectivist interpretation of quantum mechanics. But you have the disclaimer there that says, look, it might be that there's no answer to your question, but you know, this question about the quantum world. And that's okay, because bivalence isn't a principle that is right in the world. So if you decided that was the best way to interpret the quantum world, that would be okay. So it's a complex view, which I think it ought to be, right? I mean, what kind of philosophy do you want, you know, kind of coming in and saying, okay, you know, you guys have to, you know, believe, right? That would be wrongheaded. Okay, so one, two, and then back to Chris. Sorry, I'm giving other people, I can see
your chat. Well, I just want to reply to and to all of these issues.
Okay, fine. You,
before they're too far away. So I was thinking, you know, how best to put this. I think I never met a quantum measurement that didn't have an outcome at the end of the process. Bivalence. But I don't think I've ever met a quantum measurement that had an outcome before I started the process. That's something else. So this goes exactly to your question. What would Peirce say about P and Q or Q1 or Q2? I don't know what Peirce would say. But one of the reasons I've been attracted to the Jamesian string of pragmatism is I felt he did have an answer. Or at least a line of an answer that might be pursuable in mathematical terms, ultimately. And his poetic way of saying it was that truth was in the making. So this much I see about quantum measurements. When you perform a quantum measurement, you get an outcome. So if you say, is the particle here, you get yes or no. That looks like a truth value. That looks like bivalence. But because of something called Poisson-Specker theorems and ideas of locality, you're not tempted to say that truth value was there before the process of inquiry. So that's all I wanted to say. It looks like James at least has a line of attack on that kind of question. Yeah. Whereas I don't know what Peirce would have said, but on the other hand, as I admitted already, I never read more than a paragraph.
Yeah, so Peirce would agree, and that's that first kind of opening up of possibility for the anti-realist interpretation of quantum mechanics, right? Truth values do not exist in the world independently of inquirers, right? So Peirce and James are on the same page there, but truth is in the making. Well, we don't entirely make truth, because remember, for James, that, you know, my my getting, you know, good results personally from a belief in God or astrology proves it to be true.
I don't think I'm going down the line of that issue. It's rather this one, whether the truth value comes about because of some kind of process involving the...
Yeah, see, I think that's a substantive local issue rather than that general kind of philosophical issue. So, I mean, this is getting clear. The general picture requires that truth values are connected to inquirers. But they aren't connected to inquirers in this local way where inquirers, you know, cause something to be the case. Although we cause things to be the case all the time. Right? So, for example, that, you know, drunkard who lets his fist fly causes a black eye to the kid. So I'm kind of feeling that there's a, in response to this, the question up here, that we've got to distinguish between the general kind of view, which is hospitable to Andrew's interpretation of quantum mechanics, but then it's an additional question whether the local issue plays out realist or anti-realist way. It's an additional question. Yeah, so wait, that's why I said I don't know. Yes. So what term do you prefer? Right? I don't. I had a feeling. Okay, I'll never use that term again. There's a question up here.
Yeah, I was just wondering whether this is more about the limits of human, you know, the human imagination or the human's ability to inquire than it is about nature. So, you know, another question one can ask is, you know, is there a supermassive black hole sitting in the center of the galaxy? And there's sort of a limit. You know, people can say, yes, I'm sure at the sort of 99% level because I have this piece of evidence and this piece of evidence and this piece of evidence. But, you know, it may be that the absolute truth in this lies beyond our ability to measure. And so then at the end of the day, after the lecture, you have a theory and say, well, are there really supermassive black holes or aren't there? You know, will the pragmatists say, well, you know, is this really a limit on human inquiry or, you know, nature knows? Nature knows what quantum mechanics is real. But is that a meaningless question? I mean, you know, sort of what many of us, I think, hang on to is the idea that, you know, there's really something out there that's truth that we can't quite grasp in a, you know, strictly logical sense, but, you know, it's really a beautiful truth of nature that really is true.
Yeah. So on the more objective person account of truth and reality, right, there is a way the world is, but we, you know, as soon as we try to describe it, we can't even think of ourselves trying to get it right, right? Because as soon as you start to describe it, whatever is there is wrong, right? So Peirce thinks that there is a world out there that we're trying to say things about, and we are saying things about that. And so he would say that there is a determinate answer to these kinds of questions, and some pragmatists, you know, like Nick Jardine, want to invoke this notion of counterfactual bravado at this point and say, well, you know, were we able to fly into black holes, right? Were we to have these super human supernatural powers, we would be able to, these things wouldn't be beyond our limits. I don't, I'm not at all inclined to take the person pragmatist in that direction, because at the heart of this is a naturalist view about our theories and our knowledge, right? But Peirce does think that there's something on the other side, right? Truth is beyond our reach in that way, and so whereas, you know, Rorke would say that that sentence is crazy, it doesn't make sense, that question that you asked, the arguments, holes, he would say it doesn't make sense. Peirce would say it makes sense, but it's really pointless for us to make surmises about it. It's not an entirely satisfactory answer, no, but that's the best that he said, right? So for every year...
Rorty wants to put us out of work.
Yeah, Rorty wants to put us out of work. Yeah.
Well, it's not that he wants to put us out of work. He thinks we're writing literature.
Yeah, but you aren't.
Shame.
We should probably.
He just wants to reassign himself.
There are a couple more questions.
Well, if you, I can ask you later.
No, go ahead.
Okay, just quickly then. I'm wondering if there isn't room for a more robust notion of truth to creep in, and if Peirce would allow that or not. And my thinking is, as you were just explaining, his view comes equipped with a methodology. So he's saying quantum mechanicians go out and pursue the next best theory in a certain way. What if we set up an army of people who are physicists who are pursuing his methodology, his very empiricist methodology, and then we set out another army of physicists who are pursuing a methodology which involved being seriously worried about the problems of interpretations. The world really is what? What if the people who are pursuing the interpretive program got there first? And furthermore, what if this is just one of a set of these problems, and those guys always get there first? Is Peirce willing to, being a naturalist, say, okay, I was wrong, that's not the best methodology for pursuing science, the best one is actually to go out and solve interpretive problems of quantum mechanics?
Yep. But in solving those more abstract issues, you would have to get pale, right, in terms of the empirical world,
right?
Otherwise,
yeah.
It wouldn't.
Success in history.
Yeah. So that methodology is contingent on, you know, it's having been a very successful methodology. But in fact, that's the way science works, right? You know, you've got people pursuing all sorts of different research programs, and you know, a place like this is set up just so that you can pursue some non-standard research programs and see if you get there first. And you know, people argue that you know that all of the great advances are made by kind of non-standard methodologies. And so he'd be completely keen on that. It's just that you know once you, however you got there, you know, your theory would have to have these empirical payouts. And it might be that you revise your methodology, right? You wouldn't be, you know, if again and again and again, you know, highfalutin theory got you the results rather than plodding away in the lab, you know, you'd rethink how you learn about things. Maybe you wouldn't waste your time in the lab. And, right? But, you know, his bet would be that you got to do both.
One of the remarkable things about this institute is that it allows for physicists and philosophers to talk to each other. It doesn't always work. But I think people agree. I think people agree.
Nobody talks to Newhart.
I think that you'll agree that today it has worked. So please join me in thanking our speaker.
Thank you. Well, thank you.